So my work is based, all of my work really is based on a false premise. And this false premise is that people make their decisions based upon facts and reasoned analysis emerging from these facts, which would mean that if you provide people with facts and reasoned analysis emerging from these facts, that this will affect their personal and collective decisions. This is, of course, nonsense. I don't think that reason plays a great role in our decisions. I'm going to give an example. I'm going to read a couple headlines I've seen, four headlines I've seen in the last few days. They are, headline, global warming could deplete the ocean's oxygen with severe consequences. By severe consequences, they mean basically the end of fish in the oceans. That was 2 years ago. And one might think that on a planet that is primarily ocean, that we would give a shit, right? One would think that we would, you know, act decisively to stop that from happening. One would be wrong. How wrong? So 3 days ago, I read an article with a head and subhead, "Oceans suffocating as huge dead zones quadruple since 1950, scientists warn. Areas starved of oxygen in open ocean and by coasts have soared in recent decades, risking dire consequences for marine life and humanity." Here's a key quote. Major extinction events in Earth's history have been associated with warm climates and oxygen-deficient oceans. Denise Breitberg at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center in the U.S., and who led the analysis, said, "Under the current trajectory, that is where we would be headed. But the consequences to humans of staying on that trajectory are so dire that it's hard to imagine we would quite go that far down that path." Well, imagine it. Two more articles. Another day, another headline. Sea level rise projections double, painting terrifying picture for next generation. The first three sentences. In a consistent trend, future projections of an increase in the overall global temperature, as well as increases in sea level rise, continue to outpace previous worst-case scenarios. This is due to a simple equation. There is already enough CO2 in the atmosphere and heat absorbed into the planet's oceans that even if we stopped emitting carbon completely right now, the planet would continue to experience and display dramatic impacts from anthropogenic climate disruption for thousands of years. The second part of that equation is this. There is simply nothing to indicate that national governments around the world are willing to take the immediate radical steps that would be necessary to begin to seriously mitigate these impacts. And now to bring it all home, let's look at one final article. I gotta find it. And now to bring it all home, let's look at one final article. Headline, "As the Arctic melts, nations race to own what's left behind." A sample sentence. For the nations in the Arctic Council, Canada, Russia, Norway, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, and the United States, climate change presents an opportunity for access to brand new waters, previously cloaked in ice, that are chock full of valuable resources. We'll do one more standard sentence. The Russian Minister for the Environment and Natural Resources told the Daily Telegraph last year that the country was looking for recognition of exclusive economic rights to about 460,000 square miles, estimated to hold 5 billion tons of hitherto unexploited oil and gas. So that's just one example of... us not being reasonable and not making decisions based on, I mean, see, that's the thing really from the beginning. I mean, so yes, my work is based on a false premise that reason analysis actually makes a difference. but also from the beginning, over the years, I've had a couple people, a couple interviewers ask me, so what is there in my, what would be one of the few things that really separates my writing from most other people's? If I had to say it, especially among people who write about the environment. And I've always been very clear on that, which is that the problems we face are not fundamentally reasonable and are therefore not amenable to reasonable solution. And another way to put this is that years ago, maybe 12, 13 years ago now, I don't remember how long, I did a talk at Bioneers, and Bioneers is about social change. And the thing that broke my heart is that, so far as I could tell, I was the only person there who talked about either power or psychopathology. And I don't know how you can talk about social change without talking about power. And I don't know how you can talk about the murder of the planet without talking about psychopathology. So central to all of my work has been that this culture is collectively and many of us individually are insane. And we don't make decisions based on reasoned analysis. And again, there are a bazillion examples. It makes no sense to bathe the world in endocrine disruptors. It makes no sense to change the planet's climate. This is why I've said so long that if space aliens had come down from outer space and were changing the planet's climate, they were causing the greatest mass extinction in the history of the planet, they were putting endocrine disruptors along the entire world, we would resist. But we don't, because we're inside the system. And it reminds me of the line about Hitler, that it was said of him that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So once you buy into the insane premises, I mean, look, R.D. Lang's fundamental insight was that no matter how crazy someone is, from the inside, their behavior makes sense. If you see some crazy person walking down the street talking to God, the chances are really good that this person is talking to God because this person is hearing what they perceive as God. When Ted Bundy was committing his atrocities, he was doing it because it made sense to him at the time. And so there can, my point is, the fact that there can be some sort of internal logic does not mean that something is not stark raving mad. And we can have an internal logic, but that doesn't mean that reasoned analysis will get people out of it, because I think about this on an individual level as well, that I think I've seen so many people whose decisions, whose life decisions are not made based upon reasoned analysis, but based upon unmetabolized childhood wounds that, and I see this for myself as well, that, you know, trauma reconfigures the way our brain works. I don't like reconfigures anymore. I like rewires. Trauma affects our, I'm trying to stay away from machine language. Trauma affects how we perceive the world and therefore how we behave in the world. And it can affect how we process our experiences of the world. And I mean, a great example from my own life, and I've gotten better about this, but because of my childhood, it used to be especially that alcohol and drugs would terrify me. And I have written that I can't date anyone who drinks. And part of what would happen is, let's say I go out on a wonderful date and we're having a wonderful conversation, and she orders a glass of wine. When I get done with the evening, the only thing I would remember is a glass of wine. because that was triggering me from my childhood. That is not actually a reasonable response to the interaction that we were having. And this is just one example for me. We can all find those examples in our own lives of, you know, one of the smartest decisions I ever made in my life was when I was about 26 or 27, I would sit down to write and I would get terrified. I would feel, writing for me is a very emotional act. And of course, because of my childhood, emotions were very scary. And so when I would sit down to write, I would freeze up and I would sometimes go semi-catatonic. And I realized one day that, you know, I have the best excuse in the world. I mean, I can't write. It's just too scary. I've always wanted to write, but I can't do it because I was abused. And the childhood abuse gave me the best reason in the world to not write. And then the realization I had that was one of the most important in my life was I realized I can go the rest of my life with the best excuse in the world for not doing what I want, or I can do what I want. But that means that I have to go through this process. I have to try to unpack why it is that when I sit down to write, I get terrified. And that was the thing that got me into counseling. And that was the thing that got me into writing. And part of the reason that I have never believed that we will have a social transformation is that it was tremendously hard work for me to attempt to recover insofar as I have from my own childhood. And I don't see most people doing that work even on their own childhood, much less collectively. And what I see is a lot of people acting out childhood wounds. And what I see is a lot of is the culture socially acting out childhood wounds. I mean, this is another thing that I've written about extensively. One of the central theses of my work is that we have an entire culture suffering from what Judith Herman called complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And what she has done with that is that PTSD is if you're traumatized once over an event. If you're in a fire, an earthquake, and say your house burns down, then forever after that, you might be really nervous about fires. Or a great example is that my mom and I were in a terrible car wreck in which she broke her neck and became functionally blind. And this accident happened on a dark and windy road in a canyon on a dark and rainy night. And ever since then, if I drive through somewhere, like every 2 months, I drive over to Medford for a medical treatment through a canyon. And on the way home, I drive through the dark in a canyon. And my mom always gets very nervous about me driving through this canyon. She has a specific trigger associated with that. And what Judith Herman said is if you have somebody not only traumatized once, but what if they are held in captivity for years? What if they're raised in captivity? And she said, one of the things that starts to happen is that people can come to believe that, I mean, if you're in prison, you can come to believe that fully mutual relationships are not possible. That basically everything is a hierarchy. You've got guards and then you've got prisoners. And it's the same with domestic violence, that everything becomes a hierarchy. And it's very clear to me that, I mean, so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that indigenous ways of being are all about seeing the world as consisting of other beings to enter into relationship with. And the Western way of being is you see the world as consisting of resources for you to exploit, which is very hierarchical. Humans are at the top of the great chain of being, so far as excluding God or science or whatever, but humans are here and non-humans are down here. And all that is a projection of this worldview that has you been raised, this worldview of complex post-traumatic stress disorder, this belief that fully mutual relationships are not possible. And what that leads to is the conclusion that it's very clear to me that most of our religion and philosophy are not actually thought out in terms of really attending to what is real and working up from there. But instead, most of our philosophy, religion, economics is a rationalization for pre-existing bigotries and for pre-existing issues, such as, it's like, how do we rationalize that men are above women and that humans are above non-humans? How do we rationalize that? Well, you can do it through creating a god who tells you that this is the case. Or you can also do it through creating a science that tells you that this is the case. I'm reading a book right now that I would love to do a longer talk about sometime. It's about the intelligence of birds. And there's wonderfully delightful parts in it about how intelligent birds are, how it takes real intelligence for a bowerbird to create the bower, and takes intelligence for pigeons to be able to navigate. But throughout the book is the central conceit. This is that's what I like about the book. What I don't like is the central conceit that the birds are intelligent insofar they still use humans as a comparison. It is humans are the standard by which anyone else's intelligence should be measured. And as long as that's still in place, the fundamental bigotry, for example, she talks about how intelligent birds are compared to reptiles. She calls birds intelligent, reptiles not intelligent. And she doesn't seem to see that that's simply based on measuring them against our standards. The real point is that even though the book is about how intelligent birds are, it still ends up reinforcing human supremacy, which is what almost everything in this culture is about, is reinforcing our pre-existing bigotries. Why is this particular analysis important? The reason I think this analysis is important is because if you recognize that the culture is insane, and if you recognize that although discourse certainly does matter in some ways, Neil Everton's book, The Natural Alien, saved my life. You know, Judith Herman's book saved my life. They both helped me to articulate what I knew was wrong with the culture. But there's the point, what I knew was wrong with the culture. But if you fully internalize the understanding that this culture is insane, what that means is that you can't count on the simple provision of facts and analysis, such as you are killing the oceans, to change their behavior, any more than you could expect it to stop Ted Bundy by saying, hey, you're hurting women. This was the genesis of the book Endgame, which is, you know, I would go around and I would ask thousands of people around the country, do you believe this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And nobody ever said yes. But the next question is, if you don't believe that and you care about the world, what does it mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And the reason we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that if we just point out what they're doing wrong, that they will change. If we just point out what's wrong with the culture, that the culture will change. But that's not how mental illness works. And that's not how PTSD works. And that's not how ideology works. And where this really comes to is if you care about life on the planet and you fully recognize that this culture is acting out on these primarily unconscious urges that it will defend to the death, that if you want to save the planet, you simply need to stop this culture.